Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Mel Goodman, former CIA analyst, who assesses the challenges of preventing future ISIS terrorist attacks after the recent bombing of Brussels, and the belligerent response from Republican presidential candidates that alienate many Muslim Americans. Mary Grant of Food and Water Watch, who explains why the lead poisoning crisis in Flint has provoked calls for federal investment in the nation's public water infrastructure. And Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst with the National Security Archive, who discusses President Obama's historic trip to Cuba and the obstacles for normalization that lie ahead. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The International Criminal Court won a key victory with the conviction of former Congolese Vice President Jean-Pierre Bemba. According to the Guardian newspaper, Bemba commanded a rebel militia in neighboring Central African Republic, which committed mass murder and rape. Over 5,000 victims of sexual violence from the Central African Republic presented their case before the ICC in The Hague. Prosecutors insisted Bemba, who led the Congolese liberation movement, knew militia troops were committing these crimes and failed to make necessary and reasonable measures to prevent these acts of violence. The former Congolese vice president was convicted on 2 counts of crimes against humanity, in addition to 3 counts of war crimes, in relation to atrocities in the Central African Republic in 2002 and 2003. The conviction was a rare success for the International Criminal Court in Africa, which has faced stiff resistance in pressing cases against political leaders in Sudan and Kenya. Civil rights lawyers have gone to federal court on behalf of the Navajo Nation, charging the tribe's voting rights were violated by San Juan County, Utah. The lawsuit alleges the county's changeover to a mail-in ballot made it more difficult for non-English-speaking Navajos to vote. If a Navajo tribal member didn't receive a ballot or could not understand it, their only option is to drive for hours to a voting place in an all-white community. According to the news magazine In These Times, this is the 4th voting rights case filed against San Juan County. A federal judge recently overturned the county's district lines for school board and county commissioner elections. In the 1980s, San Juan County settled with the U.S. Department of Justice over its plan to impose at-large districts that diluted the voting power of the Navajo people. Plaintiff and Navajo activist Wilford Jones complained the ballot was complex and confusing. The new mail-in ballot worked well in non-Navajo areas of the county, where mail delivery is reliable and voter turnout rose. But some precincts in the Navajo Nation saw turnout drop by as much as 20% in 2014. 3 years ago, police arrested 45-year-old teacher Tammy Bond for having a sexual relationship with a 16-year-old student. She pled guilty and served 180 days in an Illinois prison and was later placed on probation supervision for 4 years. But as a convicted sex offender, Bond, an African-American woman, was required to register as a sex offender. This means Bond can't move back to her home since it was located near a child care facility. Illinois prohibits registered sex offenders from living within 500 feet of a school playground and any facility with programs for children under 18 years of age. While the movement advocating prison reform and an end to mass incarceration is now on the public agenda, there is little sympathy for registered sex offenders who face intense discrimination in securing a job or finding a place to live. Recent academic research has questioned the value of sex offender registries. According to the news magazine In These Times, children are rarely abused by strangers. Meanwhile, grassroots groups like the survivor-founded organization Stop It Now frames child abuse as a public health issue and works to educate adults and communities about prevention strategies. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
After the latest ISIS terrorist attack, that targeted the Brussels airport and a metro station on March 22nd, killing 35 and wounding more than 300. Belgian authorities admitted their failure to detect and follow up on warning signs that an attack was imminent. Belgium is well known as an epicenter for European Islamist radicals. More Belgians have joined ISIS as a proportion of the population than have residents from any other Western nation. Many of the ISIS operatives who carried out the brutal Paris attacks in November 2015 that killed 130 were Belgian nationals or residents. The Brussels neighborhoods of Molenbeek and Schaarbeek, populated by many emigres from the Middle East, have been used as a base of operations by ISIS jihadis. While the response in European capitals has focused largely on improving security and intelligence cooperation, the rise of right-wing nationalist anti-immigrant groups has opened up a new front of escalating tension and potential violence in many EU nations. In the aftermath of the Brussels attack, the toxic rhetoric of Republican Party presidential candidates in the U.S. has also been on the rise. GOP frontrunner Donald Trump has doubled down on his earlier advocacy of bringing back the use of waterboarding and more severe forms of torture, while Texas Senator Ted Cruz has called for law enforcement to monitor and patrol America's Muslim neighborhoods, as well as the carpet bombing of ISIS-held territory in both Syria and Iraq. Your reporter spoke with Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst who currently serves as a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. Here he assesses the challenges of preventing future ISIS terrorist attacks and the dangerous response among Republican politicians whose belligerent pronouncements isolate and alienate many Muslim Americans.
I think this attack has created a greater impact than any of the other attacks in Europe. When I think of the attacks in London, Paris, Madrid, Copenhagen, Thames and Amsterdam. And I think it's because Belgium has such a serious problem. Belgium itself is divided ethnically and linguistically and politically, culturally. There are a lot of political hacks that dominate key positions in the government, particularly the interior minister who submitted his resignation, but I don't think it was accepted. Maybe it should have been. There were so many clues, the fact that one of the terrorists was expelled from Turkey and Erdogan gave warning. He was sent from Turkey to the Netherlands and made his way to Belgium, but Europe was alerted to this. The sensitive communications that these terrorists can now adopt, particularly when you have brothers involved, so you can use very unsophisticated kinds of communication. You don't need cell phones, and you don't need technology. So when you look at Paris, there were brothers. Brussels, there were brothers. Actually, if you look at the Boston Marathon, there were two brothers, two Chechen brothers. So this is alarming. And when you look at the fact that ISIS appears to be having difficulties on its own turf, particularly in Syria, but also in Iraq to a certain extent, you have to wonder, and I've seen reports to this effect, that they are sending some of these fighters back to the European countries they came from to foment this kind of terrorism, and that this is maybe ISIS saying that they're losing the battle on their home turf, or at least the momentum isn't with them, but they can do greater damage in Europe and divide Europe politically against itself and divide Christians against Muslims. And you can see a lot of this in European countries that are moving to the right. You see this in France. You see this to a certain extent in Germany. You see it in Eastern Europe, particularly in Poland and Hungary. But all of this, I think, is creating a great deal of concern that Europe, which has its open borders, provides pathways for terrorists, but the borders are not open to intelligence agencies necessarily, and that there's not sufficient cooperation. Germany doesn't want to go as far as the United States has in terms of intelligence collection, particularly surveillance, because they have a lot of laws that prevent them from doing so. So there's a real moment of truth here for Europe. What to do about Brussels? What to do about the social conditions in Brussels that so many of these terrorists came out of one small neighborhood?
Mel Goodman, both Republican presidential candidates still in the race for their party's nomination have responded to the latest terror attacks by
a call for more aggressive measures, to say the least. We've had Donald Trump, who doubled down on his earlier statements to wanting to bring back waterboarding and more severe forms of torture. He said previously he wants to kill terrorist suspects' family members. We've had Ted Cruz talk about monitoring Muslim neighborhoods in the United States and reiterating his policy that would have the United States carpet bomb entire cities, inevitably killing many civilians, and then the threat of using nuclear weapons. What is the damage that is done by this kind of rhetoric from these presidential candidates?
Well, this is the kind of rhetoric that ISIS would have written for these people if they had an opportunity, because what it does is it gives credibility to Islamic State propaganda that says the West is conducting a religious war against the caliphate. And this is a tremendous source of morale for these people. I would think it would feed extremist recruitment, and it might even make moderate Muslims or Muslims who are not willing to pursue terror think that, well, you know, maybe ISIS knows what it's talking about. You know, look at what's coming out of the United States. Look at the remarks of Cruz about carpet bombing and Trump, as you say, going after the families of terrorists. And he's backpedaled from some of this, but really his instincts are, as you say, to not only do waterboarding, but to do a lot more than waterboarding, in his own words. So this is exactly the kind of rhetoric that ISIS wants. They want it in the United States. They want to see more of this in Europe. And they're getting it, whether it's Le Pen in France or the right-wing party that gained in the recent elections in Germany. We see some of that language in Poland and Hungary. And when you look at how refugees have been treated and the horrible conditions that refugees have had to deal with, and now this Faustian bargain of sending refugees back to Turkey and giving Turkey billions of dollars to keep them there, I would think all of this propaganda is helpful to what ISIS is trying to do and the kind of message they're sending about the religious war in the West against the caliphate, against Islam.
That was Mel Goodman, a former CIA analyst who currently serves as a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy. For more analysis and commentary on the response to the latest ISIS terrorist attacks, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The lead poisoning water crisis continues in Flint, Michigan, the result of a state decision to change the source of drinking water for the low-income, largely African-American population from a reliable clean source to a contaminated one, all in an effort to save money. When Michigan's Republican Governor Rick Snyder and EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy testified before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee on March 17th, legislators asked both officials to resign, but the likelihood of accountability for this series of tragic errors seems remote. Remediation and replacement of water pipes in Flint will cost millions of dollars to fix. Unfortunately, many residents, especially children, will now face a lifetime of negative health consequences as a result of the reckless decisions made by state officials. If anything good came out of the crisis, it was the interest across the country in finding out if other communities' water was also contaminated with lead. Sadly, test results find that Flint is not alone among the nation's municipalities to have a lead contamination problem, with some experiencing even higher levels of lead than was found in Flint. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus spoke with Mary Grant, director of the Public Water for All campaign, initiated by the group Food and Water Watch. Here she discusses the widespread problem of lead found in water supplies, steps residents can take to reduce the threat of lead poisoning, and the growing danger to public health as the nation ignores the urgent need to repair and rebuild our aging public water infrastructure.
Lead in drinking water is a big issue in the United States. Lead in school water in particular is a concern because it's often not tested for unless a school has its own private well and is considered its own public water system. There's no requirement at the federal level for schools to test for it. there's also no federal funding for the schools to replace those lead pipes. So what we really need to do is to open up our state revolving fund programs to provide grant programs to schools to help remove lead plumbing pipes and fixtures. The latest survey I saw from the American Water Works Association said that the United States has an estimated 6.1 million lead service lines. So that's the problem that we saw in Flint. They had these lead service lines. They didn't add anti-corrosive chemicals to their water when they switched their water source to the Flint River, which was heavily polluted, which caused lead to leach out of the pipes. Nationwide, we have 6.1 million lead service lines that serve 15 to 22 million people across the country. It will cost about $30 billion to remove the remaining lead service lines, according to estimates from the American Water Works Association.
Some of the worst contamination in schools seemed to be in the lower grades and even pre-K, where kids were brushing their teeth after lunch using that poisoned water.
There is no level of lead that is safe for children. Young developing minds are the most vulnerable to lead poisoning. As they form all these neural connections, they're very susceptible to damage from lead poisoning. It's a very vulnerable time when they're in nursery schools, elementary schools, to be exposed to lead. So we really need to remove the lead from water, especially in those places where you have these vulnerable populations being exposed to lead. It causes a lifetime of consequences to have that early childhood exposure to lead poisoning. It affects your IQ, your development, your capacity going forward. I know in Flint they're talking about all these support services that they're now going to need to help the children deal with the fallout of having been exposed and poisoned.
Mary Grant, this problem is going to cost billions of dollars to fix. And our government at all levels has not been putting money into fixing our infrastructure. What can people do in the meantime to provide safer water for children? And do you have any idea what percentage of schools or homes have actually been tested for lead? Maybe people are being poisoned and don't even know it.
Yeah, that is a big concern, particularly with schools, because there's no requirement at the federal level for most schools to test for lead. At the home level, if you're served by a public water system, the utility is required by federal law to test a certain percentage of homes that are most likely to have lead in the your home plumbing or in your pipelines to test for the lead levels there. And so they issue a water quality report every July 1st that you can read to see what percentage of homes tested above the federal action level, which is 15 parts per billion of lead in the water. I think that we do need to have the political will in Congress to actually provide the funding that we need. In the wake of the Flint crisis, we're seeing that there needs to be that renewed federal investment in our water infrastructure. There have been several bills in Congress already to provide increased funding, and they're going into appropriations, ongoing appropriations, about what those levers are going to be for this year. So we really need Congress to appropriate the correct amount of money for these dedicated federal funding sources. And then we also need to have a dedicated federal funding source for our water and sewer systems in the long term so that we can have safe and affordable water service. It can be really hard, especially if you're a small or rural system. You don't have the resources in your community to make these improvements that are necessary to protect public health. That's why the federal government plays a big role, especially in small and rural communities. If you can afford it, you can have a filter on your water tap. You can make sure that it's certified to remove lead and assessed certified to remove lead. But, I mean, not every household can afford it. And often that we see the households that can least afford to filter their own water are the ones that are most likely to be exposed to lead because it is an environmental injustice issue that disproportionately affects low-income households.
Do you see this as part of the general failure of infrastructure investment in the U.S.?
Yes, nationally, the American Society of Civil Engineers has given our water and sewer infrastructure a D rating. Many systems have old lead and cast iron pipes that need to be replaced to ensure that we have access to safe public drinking water. Because many of our nation's water systems were built in the early 20th century, and they're reaching the end of their useful lifespan.
That was Mary Grant, director of the Public Water for All campaign, initiated by the group Food and Water Watch. For more information on the group's work to ensure the public's access to safe, affordable water, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. President Barack Obama's March 20th trip to Cuba was a bold affirmation of his administration's historic decision to move towards normalizing relations with the island nation's communist government. Mr. Obama's journey to Cuba, accompanied by his wife and two children, was the first by an American president in 88 years. The initiative for warmer relations between Havana and Washington, begun in December 2014, ended a 54-year period of hostility, which was an important chapter in the Cold War era. The contemporary history of U.S.-Cuban relations includes one of the most dangerous confrontations between the U.S. and Soviet Union, where an American naval blockade of the island in October 1962 over Russia's deployment of ballistic missiles to Cuba nearly resulted in a full-scale nuclear war. The Cuban Missile Crisis was provoked by President Kennedy's earlier support for an exile army's invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs in 1961, and the CIA's multiple attempts to assassinate Cuban leader Fidel Castro. While Obama was warmly welcomed by Cuban President Raúl Castro, his older brother, former president and revolutionary hero Fidel, wrote a column urging Cubans to remember America's history of aggression. For his part, President Obama looked to a future of economic cooperation between the former enemies, with the hope that Congress would eventually lift the 54-year U.S. trade embargo against Cuba. Your reporter spoke with Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst and director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive, who discusses President Obama's historic trip to Cuba and the obstacles for normalization that lie ahead.
You know, the whole issue of tourism and U.S. corporate investment, of course, reminds older Cubans in particular of the 1950s when Cuba was the playground of the rich and famous, run by the mafia and by U.S. corporations. And so Cuba has been really, you know, slow to sign big contracts with big companies. And the Starwood contract is really the first so far with a corporation of sorts. And really that is for a hotel management investment and relationship rather than an ownership relationship. So this is a sensitive issue for the government in Cuba. It's taking its time. Nobody wants to see a return to, you know, the 50s and 40s. So it's a slow but sure process. Raúl Castro has said the economy is going to change sin prisa, pero sin pausa, which means in English, you know, it's going to change without rush, but without pause. Unfortunately, a lot of Cubans there would like to see a change rather quickly. So this is a tension in Cuba right now.
Peter, is there some concern among Cubans that with all this change, that the universal health care and universal education in Cuba could be jeopardized?
For one thing, Cubans who have benefited from that, I think, understand that there are a lot of problems with that system still. The universities don't have the resources that they need, even though people have access to the universities. Even though Cuba does have this universal health care system, a lot of doctors are sent off to other countries. There aren't enough bandages and medicines for everybody. And so even in the kind of tremendous gains of the revolution, the real pillars of what the revolution stood for, there have been great kind of losses as Cuba struggles with its economy. It doesn't really have a benefactor like it had in the Soviet Union or like it had with Venezuela for a number of years. So now the economy has to stand on its own. And Raúl Castro wants to see what he calls sustainable socialism, in which Cuba can pay for through health care, advanced education. Part of the problem is that Cubans are extremely highly educated with this system, but then there are no real jobs for them, no real opportunities. And what do? They take their education and creativity and they leave. And so Cuba wants to change that situation and it wants to control its own future. To do so means opening its economy and modernizing its economy.
Peter, I wanted to ask you briefly about dissidents in Cuba. I believe the ladies in white who generally protest on Sundays in Havana were detained briefly. What's the future of USAID financial assistance to dissidents in Cuba, whom the Cuban government dismisses as really foreign agents of one kind or another?
But look, any direct U.S. assistance to anybody in Cuba is the kiss of death for Cubans.
that money really does not go directly to the ladies in white. And I think that Obama people are trying to change these USAID, quote, democracy promotion programs into something that is acceptable to the Cubans. I'm sure that that is part of the various negotiations that are ongoing now between Cuba and the United States that have resulted from the restoration of diplomatic relations and the establishment of task forces to address key issues between the two countries, including human rights and including dissident issues. There's no doubt that the human rights issue became the issue of contention on this trip between the United States and Cuba. Secretary of State John Kerry, as I wrote in the Nation magazine, was due to go down on an advanced trip to kind of iron out a meeting that Obama would have with leaders of civil society and dissident groups, and that trip was suddenly canceled when the Cubans made it clear that they were offended by the idea of discussing it further. Obama did meet with more than a dozen of those leaders, and I think what's very encouraging to them, without certainly saying that he was going to give them any direct aid of any kind, because he knows as well as anybody that that's not useful for them. The Cubans' decision to arrest the ladies in white, you know, literally 5 hours before Obama arrived for doing nothing but actually walking to a given point as a group certainly showed that they didn't want to have the message be that they were suddenly going to go soft because the President of the United States was coming and give an opening to dissident groups. So they maintained their hardline position. You know, it's going to be up to the Cubans, and they certainly know that. I think that the gulf is made well be between the leadership and the people themselves. So we'll see what happens. I think, you know, Cuba and the United States are both their interests are served, both government interests and the interests of the societies at large by this process of normalization. So I'm hoping that it continues to move forward through the end of the Obama administration and into what will likely be a Hillary Clinton administration if Bernie Sanders doesn't come through.
That was Peter Kornbluh, senior analyst and director of the Cuba Documentation Project at the National Security Archive and co-author of the book Back Channel to Cuba. For more perspectives on the normalization of U.S.-Cuba relations, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.